Welcome to another episode of Cosmic Echo, a Taylor podcast. This podcast applies a scientific viewpoint on the strange and bizarre phenomenon that happens in our lives when we sleep in altered states. In this episode, we speak with Don Lattin, who is the author of Changing Our Minds, Psychedelic Sacraments and the New Psychotherapy. Don talks about his personal experiences with psychedelics, as well as the information in his new book dealing with psychedelics and how they can be used to help people through PTSD, addiction, and other psychological disorders. If you enjoyed this episode of Cosmic Echo and like to learn more about Don and his work, you can visit our website at taileaters.com/CE podcast, and there you can click on links that will take you to Don's work as well as his books. Additionally, if you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so through our Patreon page, located at the same site. Well, without further ado, let's get to the interview. So, Don, can you give us a little introduction about yourself and some of your past, or how you got into this whole region of study that you're into with the psychedelics and spirituality and kind of go with that?
Okay, great. Yeah. Well, my name's Don Lattin, and I'm a journalist, an author and a journalist, and I worked for many years as a newspaper reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle, which is the main newspaper in San Francisco. And so I spent many years, like 20, 25 years, writing about religion, spirituality, psychology, sociology. That was kind of my beat on the paper. So I wrote about all kinds of religion and spirituality. But I was particularly interested in the whole kind of spiritual movement that grew out of this 1960s counterculture, both the psychedelic counterculture and the broader counterculture of the 60s. Because I came of age myself in the late 60s, early 70s. So my initial interest, you know, in psychedelics was, like most people, just as a, you know, a teenager exploring and not knowing what the hell I was doing and having some amazing and terrifying experiences with LSD, you know, back when I was a teenager and in my early 20s in college. But, you know, it really did, in a sense, get me interested in spirituality and consciousness and religion. It's one of the reasons that I wound up writing about that for the newspaper. I had these kind of a transformative experiences on psychedelics that I didn't really understand. I was having kind of religious experiences, but I didn't think of myself as a religious person. And I was getting this look into the nature of consciousness and reality. And so I was always interested in that, but you know, it was quite a few years before I started writing about it professionally. The first book that I wrote specifically about psychedelics, I've published 6 books, 3 of them with HarperCollins and 3 of them with smaller presses. The first one was a HarperCollins book called Harvard Psychedelic Club. And that was a group biography of 3 guys who came together at Harvard in the fall of 1960. Timothy Leary, Richard Alpert, who went on to become Ram Dass, both of whom were clinical psychologists at Harvard. Houston Smith, scholar of world religions, who was teaching at nearby MIT, and Andrew Weil, who at the time was an undergraduate at Harvard. So this was a group biography about sort of following the lives of these 4 characters through the 60s and 70s, and some kind of inside information on what really happened with Timothy Leary and why he got kicked out of Harvard and what Andrew Weil's role in that whole story was. And that book did pretty well. It was briefly a national bestseller for HarperCollins. And I decided to write another group biography, which went back a generation, and wrote about 3 men who came together in the 1940s and 1950s who kind of laid the foundation for some of this work. And one of them was Aldous Huxley, the famous English writer, author of Brave New World and, to the point here, Doors of Perception. And a philosopher named Gerald Hurd, who you probably or many people haven't heard of.
Yeah, I haven't heard of him.
H-A-R-D. He was very influential in getting Huxley interested in spirituality and philosophy. And they both did a lot of experimentation with psychedelics back in the 50s when these drugs were still legal and used by psychologists. And they worked with Bill Wilson, who is the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. Hmm. And there's an interesting chapter in the history of AA about people using LSD way back in the 1950s to try to find a way out of their alcoholism, to have the kind of spiritual awakening that they talk about in the 12-step program to get over your addictive behavior. So that was another group biography of these three guys in the 50s. And then my most recent book, which is titled Changing Our Minds, Psychedelic Sacraments and the New Psychotherapy is the subtitle. And it's really about the research that's going on right now. A lot of clinical trials, a lot of research is going on now into trying to convince the Food and Drug Administration to reschedule MDMA, known in the street as ecstasy and Molly, and psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, to reschedule those drugs, not to legalize them, at least not yet, so they can be used to help people dealing with different kinds of mood disorders, ranging from post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, addiction issues, things like that. So the new book looks at this kind of renaissance in therapeutic work with psychedelic drugs and sacred plant medicines too. And also that the kind of the spiritual renaissance that's going on right now, and a lot of younger people are getting interested in psychedelics again. I mean, maybe they always were, it's hard to tell.
We
make up these trends, I don't think this ever really went away, but.
Yeah, you talk about that in your book as well, history behind it.
So the new book is really kind of an overview of this whole psychedelic renaissance that's going on. It's going on right now. And so those are the three books I've done. It's kind of a trilogy of books into the history of the current scene and also the future prospects for the beneficial use of psychedelic drugs.
That's interesting, man. I mean, I'm fascinated on your information and where you like how you get all that information from all these different people and put it into an actual like readable book. So like in the Harvard Psychedelic Club, how did you actually find this information about these individuals? Because I could imagine at the time you wrote it, it was pretty scattered out there and nothing was on the internet.
Well, I mean, the story, people thought they knew the story of what really happened with Timothy Leary back at Harvard in the early 60s, but the story had never really been told, the whole story about what happened with him. Well, the way I'm a journalist, so that's what I do. I interview people. I mean, I probably did, 50 or 75 interviews with people. And a lot of these people are still alive. They're getting up there, but especially I was doing that research about 10 years ago. Leary had already died, but the other three were still living. Houston Smith has since passed away. So I interviewed, the three survivors of my quartet. And, I had been writing a lot in newspaper stories and magazine stories about psychedelics and spirituality. So I'd interviewed Ram Dass several times. I'd interviewed Houston Smith. I sort of already knew that there was a story that hadn't been told yet around what happened at Harvard with Leary and Alpert and the role that Andrew Weil played. So it was just, it's just a matter of doing a lot of interviews and putting it together as a story. It was the first group biography I wrote, and it was an interesting format. It's like you can't go – if you're doing a biography of someone, you have to go really deep into the material. But when you're trying to tell four stories at once, the trick is to weave the stories together in an entertaining way that doesn't get too confusing because there's a lot of moving parts in a group biography. But what's nice is you just focus on the moments when they come together. So it, in some ways, it kind of simplifies the process as a storyteller. I really enjoyed writing that book, and people seemed to enjoy the book because it did pretty well. And that's one of the reasons that my second book was another group biography, which was the Distilled Spirits. The subtitle, which is ridiculously long, Getting High, Then Sober, with a famous writer, a forgotten philosopher, and a hopeless drunk.
Whoa, yeah, that's a lot of words there.
The hopeless drunk was Bill Wilson, the co-founder of AA. And that's also partly a recovery memoir. I wrote a little bit about in that book about my own struggle in the past with alcohol and addictive drugs like cocaine. I have a long and kind of checkered history in terms of experimenting with these substances. I write about that a little bit in the new book too, because when I started Changing Our Minds, doing the research about 4 years ago for this, I hadn't done any drugs at all for 8 years. I mean, no marijuana, no alcohol, nothing stronger than a double espresso for 8 years. And I thought I needed to experience the psychedelic medicines in the context I was writing about. So in a therapeutic way or in a shamanic or spiritual way. So that was an interesting adventure to kind of reopen myself to those realms. So I write about my personal experience a little bit in Changing Our Minds, but mostly it's based on interviews with the neuroscientists, clinical psychologists, the people actually doing these clinical trials and the research subjects, and then also people in the shamanic world. So I traveled to South America to work on that. I went to one of the leading neuroscience labs in Switzerland. I went to Mexico. I went to an Ibogaine clinic where heroin addicts were being treated with Ibogaine, which is another psychedelic plant medicine, to treat their heroin addiction. The new book is kind of an overview of what's happening now. So if you're trying to get a good idea of this, the whole territory, kind of an aerial view of the whole territory, I think it's a good book.
Yeah, I've been reading through it. It's an excellent book in that sense. It definitely has given me a overview of current things that are happening today, even that I continually hear about in the news, especially the one with the veteran being taking MDMA.
MDMA. Yeah,
I always mess that up.
Yeah. No, there's a huge problem with these returning war veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq with post-traumatic stress disorder and other brain injuries, both psychological and physical injuries. And they're finding that MDMA in these clinical trials, which are, government approved, above board, people are taking MDMA, under the supervision of a therapist and working through these fears and this trauma that they experienced and having really amazing results. So it's a huge problem for the government. I mean, the VA, the military and the Veterans Administration, they're spending, hundreds of millions of dollars at least on disability claims for people with PTSD, soldiers with PTSD. So it's a huge problem, and a lot of the existing treatments are not very effective. And so the first chapter of the new book, Changing Our Minds, is titled Wounded Warrior, and it's a real detailed look at one guy's story, Nigel McCurry, who was a Marine who served in in Iraq. And his story of healing with this therapy. And so I go into that story in pretty intimate detail.
Yeah, it was a great story, man. I mean, I was in the military for 14 years and have a lot of friends that not a lot, thankfully. I was in the Navy, so we generally don't get a lot of PTSD kind of experiences being on like ships and stuff. But you still experience a little bit of stress related work environment. But I do have friends that have had PTSD and had to experience their them while working. Still, they were still in the military. Them expressing their PTSD and kind of having to work through that with them. And there's not really any resources to do that besides counseling or medications through the government, and generally those aren't the most positive, and there's something you have to continue to use. So it's definitely an area where I've used psychedelics, so I know the benefits of it, and I wish I could tell my friends hey, try this, but being illegal and things like that, it's rather hard to convince those people that this maybe would be something that could save them.
Yeah, well, it's tricky because in the military, there's kind of also kind of a macho culture, to deal with PTSD. They used to call it shell shock or battle fatigue, and this is kind of this, you don't really talk about it. You don't want to express your fears or your weaknesses. And so a lot of these guys are, I think, struggling with that. And MDMA in particular, some people call it an empathogenic drug because it increases empathy and compassion and allows people to talk about things that the fears that they usually wouldn't be comfortable talking about. So it seems to be uniquely suited for people suffering with post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, not just military people. I mean, women who've been sexually, assaulted or anyone, who's had a traumatic experience that they haven't been able to process and put behind them. And, the clinical trials that are going on, which are expanding this year into the final of three phases, they're taking people who are treatment resistant, So these are the people who have like the worst cases in some ways.
Wow.
And they are getting, and they're having amazing results with those people. So, wow. You know, the federal government, which may have been a little reluctant, you know, to decriminalize MDMA because it's seen as like a party drug,
right.
And, you know, the rave drug and all that. You know, they're so far they're following the science, and the science is showing that this can really be effective, you know, in a therapeutic situation. And it's really looking good. Like in a few years, they could actually reschedule it so therapists could use it on patients.
Wow.
And some people say that's like the first step towards legalization, kind of like what happened with marijuana, with medical marijuana,
yeah.
Leading to legalization for recreational.
Yeah,
purposes.
I mean, even though like I live in Washington and marijuana is legal here, it's still, you know, no one in the military can use it. But, you know, I have chronic pain. That's the reason I got out of the military, and I use marijuana, and it absolutely helps my chronic pain. But if I was in the military, the only option I would have was to use pain medications, and I wouldn't even use those because they were obviously addictive, and they were becoming that way pretty quickly for myself. So it'd be
yeah.
amazing if we had alternatives like something like that that could help these people while they're still in. And additionally,
it's
like
such a tragedy. That we can't.
Alcoholism, I mean, huge.
This opioid epidemic is so bad. I mean, and that's one that could be, it doesn't work for everyone, but for some people, marijuana is really effective.
Oh yeah, so. Yeah. Opium is crazy in Seattle area too. It's out of control. So definitely need some help in that area.
Yeah, that's because when I was writing I have several chapters on people dealing with addiction with psychedelic therapy. I mentioned the Ibogaine, which is mainly
yeah.
for heroin addicts and opioid addicts. It's uniquely suited for that particular medicine. But also using psilocybin with therapy to treat people with alcoholism and smoking, just cigarette smoking. Hmm. There have been studies showing that it's been really effective in that. And you know, for some people, it's like it's kind of counterintuitive. Like, oh, you're using one drug to
yeah.
to solve addiction to another drug. That sounds crazy. Well, not really, because the thing to remember about psychedelics and therapy, it's not so much the drug, excuse me, that's having the effect. It's the experience that's occasioned by the drug, the insight, the psychological or spiritual insight that's occasioned by the drug. That's what I think really is doing the healing. So these drugs are really different in terms of used medically or therapeutically than other drugs like opioids or anything.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they have to go through all the same kind of jump through all the same hoops of the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, to get them reclassified. And so these clinical trials, they have to do double blind placebo-controlled studies. So they have to give some people the MDMA, some people a placebo, and it's, you know, most people can tell
yeah, yeah.
if they've gotten a placebo or not.
Yeah.
So in some ways it's kind of a farce, but they are showing that it's really effective, you know, so.
That's great, man. Yeah. For somebody like yourself that saw the psychedelics kind of getting banned from the government, you know, into where we are today, where it's starting to come back. I noticed you wrote an article about it, talking about like psychedelics are kind of back. How did that, you know, experience throughout that time period, how's that kind of changed your perspective on drug use and as well as like the country and the policies in general and how like legalization came about and all that?
Yeah, well, you know, they say we had the war on drugs, right?
Yeah.
Which was declared by Richard Nixon in the 1960s, which, you know, we talk about these endless wars. I mean, there's the ultimate endless war and the ultimately ineffective endless war. But it's not really war on drugs. It's a war on some drugs, you know. I mean, you know, of course, the history of you know, prohibition in this country with alcohol and various drugs. Often a drug is criminalized because a certain type of person is using it. Like, you know, with marijuana, when they were cracking down on marijuana, you know, in the 30s and 40s and 50s initially, a lot of that was very racially tinged, you know, that was like tax on African Americans and like jazz musicians or inner city people who were smoking reefer. You know, it was as much to do with race as it was with any kind of a public health concern. And, you know, in the 1960s, what happened with psychedelics is they were embraced by the counterculture, and part of the counterculture was a political movement. It was questioning the wisdom of the war in Vietnam, or people fighting for civil rights, or environmental protection, and a lot of this. So a lot of the psychedelic counterculture got kind of mushed together with the political and social counterculture, and people in the Nixon administration realized that, you know, one way to control people in these movements was to increase the drug penalties for marijuana, and then to criminalize a lot of the drugs that people had been using, for the most part, safely and sanely. You know, people forget that LSD was legal until 1966. I mean, until 1966, and in the 50s, you know, it was. I mean, it was used a lot by therapists. It was almost in Canada. It was almost went from being an experimental treatment to basically almost a mainstream treatment for alcoholism. So, you know, these are political decisions about which drugs you ban and which drugs you promote. And, like we see that now with the federal government, you know, these ridiculous laws against marijuana on a federal level, whereas, you know, many states, including yours and here in California, you know, have completely legalized marijuana. But like you said before, people who could get some help with it for pain or in the military can't use it. So it's a crazy situation. And what's happening in terms of the legalization now is there's kind of two tracks, and I write about both of these in Changing Our Minds. There's the therapeutic tract, where you have a psychologist showing that these drugs can be safely and effectively used to help people. So as therapy. So that's a medical model. So they're really imposing a medical model on this. And some people have questions about the wisdom of that. There's a lot of debate within the psychedelic community about this, but yeah. It's one way to get people to look at these drugs in a different way when you show they actually can be used medically to help people. And then there's the religious freedom aspect. About 20 years ago, there was a Supreme Court decision which opened up, which allowed Native American churches to use peyote in their spiritual rituals. And in more recent years, there have been some rulings that have allowed certain churches to use ayahuasca, which, as you probably know, is a plant medicine. It's a tea brewed from two plants indigenous to the Amazonian basin, South America. And so there are two Brazilian churches that have a lot of congregations in the U.S. and teachers in the U.S. that now can legally use this psychedelic plant medicine in their religious services. So that's why the subtitle of my book is Psychedelic Sacraments and the New Psychotherapy. So you have, in a religious and spiritual way, you have people claiming correctly that this is a question of religious freedom.
Yeah,
I would argue that it's really cognitive freedom. We should have the right to control our own mind, but because of the law, there's more openness to if you put it in the context of religious freedom. So in both cases, that there's a kind of a normalization of practice of using these medicines and sacraments in those two ways. So it's a really interesting time right now. Things are changing pretty fast.
I find it absolutely bizarre. Like, I mean, the crazy thought that it's illegal to take a plant substance. You know what I mean? It's illegal.
A mushroom.
Right. It's illegal to use a mushroom. Like, that's insane. It just blows my mind that that's illegal. Like,
yeah, they grow out of cow shit. You know,
yeah,
there
exactly.
They are.
It's everywhere. Yeah, that's crazy, man. But I'm glad it's changing.
Maybe in 30 years, we'll all be laughing about, like, how could they? Well, you know, but, you know, I mean, we had prohibition, right?
Yeah.
There was a time in this country when aspirin was illegal and cocaine was legal. I mean, there's no sense to the law.
Yeah.
Very little sense to the law.
Well, I'm glad that, you know, we can laugh about it. At least.
Well, this is what happened in the 60s. Most people, just a lot of people, I mean, in my circles, at least, people just ignored it, you know, I mean, and they still do. I mean, you know, millions of people are probably taking MDMA every weekend in this country. I mean, I think that's pretty much a known fact. So, you know, it's like this. It's But the problem with that is that, you know, when drugs are illegal, a criminal element gets involved in it, and you have issues of crime and purity. I mean, you know, most of the MDMA sold on the street is not MDMA, or it's cut with more dangerous drugs. This whole opioid epidemic and all these overdoses, a lot of that's because the opium or the heroin is now cut with fentanyl, you know, which is a very powerful opioid, and it's killing people hundreds of people every week are dying. You know, it's a huge problem, and it's because, you know, it's because of the legal situation. People are forced to go underground. I mean, it's a tragedy.
Yeah, that's insane, man. Well, I'm glad things are changing. With your writing, like when I was reading the Harvard Psychedelic Club book, the one thing that I was really interested in is, it's a great book, but I was interested in you and like what was like, you know, who you were and how you, as a journalist, you write about these people, in this way, because generally when people, you know, are interested in psychedelics, they just want to tell everybody about their experience, you know? So it's interesting to have somebody that has a different way of writing like yourself, where it's more about the other people versus yourself. You're not telling your story, you're telling their story. So I'm wondering how did you get in that way? What drove you to journalism in general, I guess? And then, you know, going that direction.
Well, I mean, that's what journalists do. I mean, you know, I'm kind of old school, you know. I mean, I was a newspaper reporter for many years, and now a lot of people are writing about their own story and their own experience. And some of that is good, but some of that can be kind of self-indulgent, you know? So when I was as a journalist, you know, kind of coming up in the 70s and 80s, I mean, I was kind of a dirty word. You didn't really write about it. It wasn't about you, you know. I mean, you're not there to write about you. You're there to write about other people, supposedly more important people, more interesting people, or whatever. But that's just what journalists do. I mean, there was sort of a new journalism where people like writers like Tom Wolfe and Hunter Thompson, they were kind of putting themselves more in the story, and that was fun. That was fun, and that was a kind of a but you know, for the most part, you know, you're writing about other people. And interesting you should mention that, though, because in Harvard, I don't know if you remember, but in Harvard Psychedelic Club, I don't have myself in the book at all until the very end. There's an afterword where I do write about some of my own experiences, you know, both good and bad with LSD back when I didn't know what I was doing. And in Changing Our Minds, the new book, I'd say 75% of it, 80% of it is, it's other people's stories, the stories of people using these sacred plant medicines in a spiritual way, or the research subjects or the researchers in the clinical trial. But I also thought it was important for me to experience these substances in the context in which they're being used. So I went to Brazil and participated in some ayahuasca circles down there.
Okay.
And I tried to use these in as close as I could get into the kind of context of a therapeutic process. I couldn't get in the actual clinical trials because I didn't qualify. You have to have a very particular disorder or something. But I really wanted to understand them as they're being used therapeutically, not recreationally, which is how most people, you know, use them. Well, there was always a spiritual element to it. You know, even when I was really young and just sort of like a whole new appreciation of nature and the wonder and the symmetry of nature and the beauty of the earth, you know, I mean, there was always a spiritual aspect to it and a kind of a exploration of consciousness aspect to it. It wasn't just fun. It wasn't just recreation. But, you know, to be honest, a lot of times it was, you know, it was concerts and parties and, you know, all of that. And nothing wrong with that. But that's a very different way of using these substances that I'm writing about in the new book. And that's what people have to understand, you know, that it's very different when you have a particular intention. You're trying to work on a particular mood disorder or trauma that you can't get over, or an addiction issue. It's not recreational, and it's often not fun, and it can be very difficult. And some of the hardest trips that people have, the so-called bad trips, can be the most productive, because with a trained therapist, you go through that the horror and the fear that you're experiencing, and they can help you integrate whatever insight you have into your life I mean, that, see, that's what I mean. And I write about this a little bit at the end of Harvard Psychedelic Club and in the new book, Changing Our Minds. I wish I had a guide to help me back, yeah. You know, in the early 1970s, you know, when I was 18, 19 years old and I was, you know, basically blowing my mind out with mega doses of LSD and having really a kind of a psychotic break and having a, you know, some long term, not long term, but for several months, you know, I had some kind of scary experiences. I thought I'd fried my brain. I was having flashbacks. They talked about, you know, I used to think the flashbacks were like anti-drug propaganda, you know, yeah. But I actually had them, you know, and they weren't fun.
Yeah.
Cause they would, and so I wish I had had a guide who I could turn to, you know, to help me when I, through those difficult periods that I had back when I was younger. And so that's why I'm so hopeful about the situation now, because, you know, while these drugs are not dangerous in the sense, for the most part, of being addictive, like cocaine or alcohol or tobacco or opioids, they can be psychologically dangerous and difficult if you're not ready for them and you're doing them in an unsafe setting. So that's one of the things we learned in the 1960s and 70s with the importance, they say, of set and setting.
Okay.
But what's your intention? I think that we, you know, kind of learned a lot. Sometimes some of us learned the hard way, and people are still learning. People are still learning the hard way. Nothing, yeah. There's nothing really changed in that sense. So you know, I'm hopeful that people can approach these realms in a more kind of intelligent way, and a way that can be more productive.
Yeah.
Because you know, people have profound experiences on psychedelics, but. You know, for me, it's like, well, what do you do with that experience? I mean, what do you learn from it? Does it change the way you live your life? Does it make you a better person? Does it change the way you relate to your husband or your wife or your friends or family? What you do for a living? I mean, how does the insight that you have spill over into your actual life? And that's the trick, you know, that to really have to really use these substances in a beneficial and productive way, I think.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with having some fun and some kicks, you know, okay, fine. But but we're really talking about something else, at least especially in the new book that I wrote. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like it's going in right now it's going in a different direction with the research. It's not talking about having a wonderful experience on psychedelics. It's talking about having like
people are still using psychedelics the old fashioned way, you know, I mean, you know, going to concerts or raves or whatever, but that's, you know, but what I'm writing about in the book is, and that's what people have to understand, that this is a whole other approach to the use of psychedelics.
Yeah.
It's not the only approach, but it's the one that I'm writing about in this book.
Yeah. I mean, and it's a good point that you made that, you know, people, in bad settings, I guess you could say, they can have pretty traumatic experiences. The second time I ever used any type of psychedelic, I definitely had what I consider a bad trip, and it lasted for the anxiety, and I would call it PTSD actually, caused by the trip itself, lasted for quite a while after the experience itself. But I'm able to smile and laugh about it now, but the time is pretty extreme. So I've never thought of those substances as actual party drugs, oddly enough. I've always thought of them as medicine especially after that experience, where I'm like, this is something to be taken seriously, not a, you know, just to be taking and then going to a dance club or something, especially
right.
You know, the harder psychedelics.
And it also depends on which psychedelic you're talking
right,
about
yeah.
and what dose you're talking about. I mean, dose is very important, you know. So that's sort of knowing what you're doing and knowing what you're getting.
Yeah.
And when you're buying stuff on the street, you don't know what you're getting for the most part, unless you have it tested and go to all that trouble, which, you know, most people don't. They should. They really should, but they don't.
Well, with your travels in your new book, can you tell me about some of those experiences? Like, I'm interested to know the difference between, say, the veteran drug trial, and then for his PTSD, and then you went to the Amazon, used ayahuasca, and then Mexico with ibogaine. I'm wondering, you know, these settings are very dramatically different. So I've never gone to the Amazon, never gone to Mexico, and never been in a clinic with a VA veteran going through PTSD trials. So I'm interested how that played out in your mind.
Yeah, well, you know, the experience, well, maybe, I mean, the experience with the veteran, this guy named, his name Nigel McCurry, and I didn't actually sit in on his session with him, because that wouldn't have been appropriate, but they videotaped these sessions. It looks like when you read it, it looks like I was there.
Yeah, I thought you were there.
Because there's a level of detail, but what happened was they videotape these sessions.
That makes sense.
And they go on for 5 or 6 hours, right? They videotape them. They videotape all of them. And, you know, I got the permission from both the patient and the therapist, you know, to actually look at the video. So that's how I was able to describe in detail, you know, in terms of like what was being discussed and how they were. I mean, the way these sessions basically work is you're in a very comfortable room. The volunteer research subject or the patient, whatever you want to call them, are in a very comfortable room, kind of set up to look more like someone's apartment than a hospital room. And before they even take the MDMA, they meet several times with the therapists. There's a lot of screening to make sure they don't have any pre-existing medical conditions or psychological conditions that could be hazardous. So there's a lot of preparation. And then when they have the actual session, which is usually with two therapists, often a man and a woman, because sometimes people are dealing with, you know, sensitive issues like rape or something where they'd be more comfortable talking to a woman or a man or whatever. So there's usually and these go on for 5 or 6 hours. So the therapists need to take a break. And the patient is listening to, has headphones on, listening to music and eye shades. And the whole idea is you're going within and you come in with an intention to look at an issue in your life, whether it's the trauma you experienced in the war or whatever. But in some ways, the therapist does very little. They're sitting there to help you if you hold your hand or reassure you or to talk when you're ready to talk. So the subject will basically listen to this kind of evocative music, kind of eye shades, kind of go within. And then
do you know what kind of music they're listening to? Is it kind of like a consistent drum beat?
It's all
thing?
Kinds of, sometimes it's kind of like indigenous kind of tribal music.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes it can be classical music. It's not like pop music.
Yeah.
But it tends to be music that with maybe nature sounds in the back, kind of new, a lot of it's kind of new agey music, electronic music. There's actually a whole art to designing a soundtrack to kind of elicit certain feelings and experiences. And I experienced this myself when I didn't qualify in a clinical trial, but I did do some work with an underground therapist.
Okay.
Now there's a whole underground world of people doing this. You know, it's illegally doing this work in the therapeutic context. And they often say that the music drives the medicine. So, you know, you're basically kind of putting yourself, you're taking a psychedelic drug, but there's also sort of a sensory deprivation thing going on where you're, you know, eye shades. So you're going within. And I found that in one session that I had, I was actually dealing with a death of some really close friends. And I write about this in the epilogue of the book. Maybe you haven't gotten there yet, but the very end of the book, I write about this in Changing Our Minds. And I was sort of dealing with some unexpressed and unresolved grief for losing some real dear friends in the last year. And one of them had just died like a week before the session happened to have been scheduled. And I hadn't really cried. I hadn't really grieved. And on the this happened to be psilocybin, and it was actual mushrooms I was taking with the therapist. And sometimes when I take mushrooms, I actually kind of – it's enlivening, and I feel good and kind of happy and, you know, kind of that in Mexico they call them the little clowns. You know, everything seems kind of silly and profound at the same time. But I was actually kept having to remind myself that, no, I'm here for a reason to really look at this – loss in my life, right? That was what I was, and so you put the eye shades on and you kind of go within with that. And at some point the woman put on more of a kind of an kind of classical music, with a lot of orchestration and strings. And just hearing the rising crescendo of the strings kind of made my heartstrings snap. And I saw what they mean when they say the music drives the medicine. It's you're so open to the power of, you're so much, at least I'm more open to the power of music when I'm on these medicines. And when you're going into it with a healing intention, the music can be as important as the medicine. And that's what I kind of experienced, you know, with the psilocybin session with this underground therapist. And then I started crying. I mean, just wailing and moaning, which I don't, you know, I'm kind of old school. Guys don't show my emotions as much as I probably should. You know, I bottle things in. And I had been, you know, busy with memorial services and, you know, doing the stuff you do when somebody dies and hadn't really emotionally experienced it. And the psilocybin really helped me. It really, I mean, it was hard. It was, I could barely, I was gasping for breath. I was crying and, you know, and the therapist is just there to hold my hand saying, you know, yes, yes, you know, let it out. You know, I mean, it's just, but there is really a skill to that, to devising the soundtrack, being a great listener, you know, having a presence. And so I found it, you know, it was a very healing experience for me. And so that's when I said before that that's why I wanted to, I didn't go into this just as a journalist interviewing other people. I didn't want to write mostly about myself because that's a little self-indulgent, you know, I mean, but I had to also, I was interviewing people who were talking about very personal stuff like sexual abuse and addiction and depression, you know, and I was asking them to open up and tell me their stories. So I felt like, you know, I sort of needed to do that myself. So, you know, I had to be maybe a little more self-revealing than I would have been comfortable with in the book. But I thought that as a writer also that, you know, kind of was a helpful device because I showed the reader that I was, you know, willing to experience this myself and try to understand it, you know, as much as I could.
Wow. That's impactful for me listening to that, man. That brought up a lot of, you know, memories from my experiences on psychedelics where they really brought out a lot of pain, you know, that I had deep inside me that needed to get out. And it's interesting that, you know, I've never done it in a setting with a therapist, even underground or anything like that. So I'm kind of, you know, my own therapist in a way. And
That's how most people have done it. Yeah. But it's great
sounds,
having someone.
Yeah. It sounds really beneficial to have somebody there that can actually help you through that.
Yeah. And that's why these clinical trials are important because, you know, there is this whole underground therapy scene, but it's illegal. So it's hard to plug into because the therapists are really taking a chance. Like if someone has a bad experience, they could turn them in, you know, I mean, it's dangerous work. And, there are people with varying amounts of skill doing this too, you know, because it's not regulated. So, but there are a lot of really good therapists out there, but finding them is not easy. And the other thing is it's not cheap, you know, I mean, and, so one of the reasons that it's important to have these drugs decriminalized is I mean, the ultimate goal, whether this will happen or not, remains to be seen, is this health insurance would pay for this. Like it would pay for, checking into rehab for alcoholism or drug addiction or for depression or other kinds of treatment for mood disorders. So they're hoping that if the drugs are decriminalized, that people will be able to afford to do this work because the drugs themselves are not expensive, but it's the time with the therapist because you're spending probably, you know, 5 or 6 hours before the session and, you know, maybe that many time afterwards and the session itself. So, you know, it adds up if you're dealing with a psychiatrist who's charging hundreds of dollars an hour.
It'd be very expensive.
It's not cheap. Yeah. It gets very expensive. And that's also one of the critiques is that, you know, this whole medicalization model is some people think that's wrong, that it just should be done more on an informal kind of a self-help basis, kind of like, you know, maybe in the recovery movement, 12-step, you know, kind of circles or veterans themselves getting together. You don't really – some people say you don't really need to medicalize it. So there's a whole debate going on right now within the community about the wisdom of this. And then also there's people thinking they can make money on it.
Right. Yeah. That's the biggest concern that I would have.
You know, there's some big players are suddenly jumping in.
Yeah.
Into this world. So, a lot of people were afraid that the Trump administration was going to crack down on these clinical trials, but actually the opposite seems to be happening because the guy who's in charge of the Food and Drug Administration is for, they want big pharma to be able to, you know, make it easier for them to bring new drugs to market. So they're actually less concerned about regulation, at least so far. It seems like it's not getting in the way that way. But
there's money to be made, you know? So probably Trump would be all about that.
There is and there isn't, because one of the things about this psychedelic therapy is often people will only have one or two sessions.
Oh, yeah. That's good.
And that's it.
And then they're fixed.
You know, so it's not like a traditional antidepressants where you're taking a drug every day for years. There's a profit motive in that. And the profit or the expense in this is more the therapist time than the drug. And, you know, a lot of people talk about having like one or two sessions was like 5 years of therapy, of traditional talk therapy, you know. So in a way, there isn't a good economic model in terms of making money off it. But of course, this is America. People are looking for ways to
figure it out.
Talk off of it, you know.
So, I mean, you talked about the veteran and therapist, and then also your personal therapist. How was that difference between the traveling to South America and taking ayahuasca and
It was completely different because with my underground therapist and with the vet who I wrote about in the first chapter of the book, that was the therapeutic. Basically, it's a therapeutic aspect. The other was really religious or spiritual. And there are, you know, as you probably know, there's quite a brisk business in terms of drug tourism of people going down to Peru, mostly Peru, but also Brazil and other places. But it's very big in Peru. Shamans with varying amounts of credibility are operating down there. And people are going down and having basically involved with shamanics, kind of a spiritual setting. So I went to Brazil. I went to a retreat center. It's in the jungle, about 3 hours outside of Rio. And this was ayahuasca, which is a psychedelic tea brewed from two plants. And it's sort of similar to the peyote rituals of the Native Americans, where you're up all night, you're in a circle, you're chanting, you're singing sacred songs, and you're drinking the tea. In my experience, we had three times during the night where we would kind of ritually go up and we'd drink the tea. We'd go back in the circle and there would be singing and drumming and it went on all night, you know, until sunrise. And that was actually, in terms of the personal experiences I had for the book, that was the first one that I did. Like I said before, it's the first time I'd had any mind altering substance in eight years.
Okay.
Stronger than a double espresso. Cause I basically sobered up and I'd stopped everything, including alcohol.
Wow.
And still don't drink. But anyway, so I actually had some, even though I wasn't, my intention was not to, deal with my addictive sort of tendencies and my abuse of alcohol in the past, that sort of came up because it was the first time I'd had like an altered state of consciousness, sort of a drug-induced altered state of consciousness. And of course, I want more. That's where I go, you know. I mean, unchecked, that's where I go. I want more. And so I felt like I wasn't getting enough of the tea, and like the portion wasn't big enough for me. And I was going through this crazy kind of resentment about it, you know, as I'm coming on. And meanwhile, we're singing these songs in Portuguese. And I write about this in a chapter, it's called Into the Jungle, where I don't have to go into all the details, but basically what it was, you're up all night, everyone's dressed in white. It was a group of people that I'd been with for 2 weeks. There was another kind of a workshop that had been going on that I was there for. And then this was at the end, where there were two nights we did all night ayahuasca circles. And so, yeah, I was comfortable with the people there. I gotten to know the people and the shaman, who wasn't really a shaman. He was more of a musician who was doing this as a shaman. But actually, the music was great. It was he's a great jazz guitarist, and the quality of music was better than at your typical shamanic circle.
Wow.
And I appreciated that because I play guitar myself. And anyway, but I had a very powerful experience, some insight into my addictive nature of my mind. Hmm. And, you know, they say that, ayahuasca is like a teacher, that some people believe that the plants or the tea almost has an intention or a consciousness, or it can kind of lead you where you need to go.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have trouble kind of rationally kind of believing that. But when I took the tea and, you know, up all night in the jungle, in the circle, I started experiencing that. And it felt like I was getting a tour of my own brain, and this, and the teacher was like having me look at the addict brain versus my kind of higher consciousness brain. And we got into this kind of conversation with the two parts of my brain, and I was kind of listening to it. And meanwhile, this music is going on in the back, and I'm, you know, reading into it in various ways. And I felt, anyway, at the end, I felt like I actually got some insight into the addictive nature of my mind, right?
Yeah.
Which is wasn't what I was looking to do or see, but it just came up because it was, you know, partly because the first time I'd been high in 8 years.
Yeah.
And I looked at that and you know, in a sense there was some knowledge or some insight into that. It wasn't like, so a lot of people who do this are struggling with addiction in the moment, right?
Yeah,
I mean, people
exactly.
who are trying to kick, whether it's alcohol or heroin or whatever. And I really could see how that could really help you because, you know, I mean, so much of it, there's a physical aspect of addiction, but there's also obviously a psychological and a spiritual component to addiction. And it really showed me how these medicines can work to help people who are addicts. And it was just a beautiful experience. I mean, you're in the jungle, you're hearing the birds and the insects and you're up all night and you're with this group of people and there's a bonding, there's a communion, there's a community. It was a beautiful experience. Mm. Then you do this two nights in a row. And so I felt very, very fortunate to be able to experience it.
Wow.
and write about it.
That's really cool, man. Those sound like vastly different experiences as well. You know, like,
yeah, they are. It's really the difference between you know, therapy and spirituality. There's some overlap, you know, obviously in it. But, you know, the funny thing about the therapy is a lot of people a lot of the research subjects, the volunteer research subjects, some of them, because a lot of this work is being done at universities, they might be professors or graduate students or something. Yeah. They're not particularly religious people for the most part. They're not, you know, but they have on these, especially with psilocybin, people have these profound religious experiences and it kind of blows them away because they're not, and a lot of times these people have never done psychedelics before. That's the other thing. They're kind of in the clinical trials are often looking for people who have not experienced psychedelics. And it's the kind of thing that's, yeah, if anyone has done high dose psychedelic experience, you know that the first time is kind of like often the most amazing because it's this whole world you didn't know existed. This whole way of looking at reality and consciousness and, you know, being and non-being. And, you know, I mean, it's just, it can be literally mind blowing.
Yeah.
Right?
That would blow me away.
And so a lot of times these are, you know, these might be secular scientists who are research subjects who are having these experiences and it kind of blows them away because they don't think of themselves as spiritual or religious and they're having these experiences. But I think a lot of the power in a lot of the healing actually comes from that.
Yeah.
You know, just kind of ontologically shaking yourself up that, you know, they ask people like there's like, for instance, the cigarette, the research into smoking cessation, you know, they ask people later, well, okay, so you stop smoking after this mushroom trip.
Yeah.
Why? I mean, how did that work? And they'll say things like, I don't know. It's just smoking didn't seem important anymore.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And in some ways, it doesn't matter what the addiction is. It can kind of there's some kind of drug therapies that are designed, other drug therapies that are designed for particular kind of addiction, whether it's alcohol or whether it's opiates or whatever, cocaine. This, it doesn't seem to matter what the addiction is, because it's healing or treating you at a deeper level. I think kind of more on almost a spiritual level or a psychological level, that's really getting to the root cause of the addiction, rather
yeah, that makes
than
sense,
the
yeah.
physical, you know, physical yeah. aspect to it, which is real too. Which is why the ibogaine. There's a chapter on ibogaine in the book where I went to a clinic in Mexico where they specifically deal with heroin addicts and opiate addicts.
Yeah, I'm wondering how was the difference between that and the other two.
Well, it's very different. My experience in Brazil was with just a sort of a general population of people. They weren't all addicts or dealing with one particular problem. And it was but the ibogaine clinic, there's ibogaine is taken from a West African bark. It's a psychedelic plant, sacred plant medicine from a West African bark shrub. And what's interesting about ibogaine with heroin or opioid addiction is that it actually treats the physical. It operates on two levels. People, like, if you talk to junkies who've tried to kick, there's often like the withdrawal can be like a week or two of hell. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people will relapse because they just the way to stop the withdrawal is to shoot up or take some more pain pills. So they don't have the patience or the power to get through a week or two of hell to physically clean up.
Yeah.
Forget about anything else. But with the ibogaine, these addicts talk about they go through the physical withdrawal in one night.
Wow.
And
is it intensified? Like, I mean, is it like extreme withdrawal
It only relates to opiates. It's not like it wouldn't work the same way with alcohol or another addiction. That's one of the that's what's kind of interesting and unique about ibogaine with opioid addiction. Hmm. It's so effective in terms of the physical withdrawal. Well, people often have a very difficult night.
Yeah.
I mean, because they're also looking at all the stuff they've done as an addict, which is often not a pretty picture, right? You could be stealing from people or prostituting yourself or all the things you've done, right? Stealing from your family, whatever. You're looking at all that, and it can be very hard in terms of psychologically and spiritually. But the physical withdrawal, you can get through it in one night. And then what happens, it's almost like a double-edged sword, because a lot of the addicts think they're cured because the physical addiction is gone, but they're not dealing with the other aspects of the addiction. So they often will relapse. They'll come back and they'll get back into the same scene what they're into. I talk about that in the chapter on ibogaine. And they also, in that clinic, they use ibogaine, and they also use this they call it the toad medicine.
Okay, yeah, like 5-MeO.
5-MeO-DMT, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
And I didn't try the ibogaine, but I did try the toad medicine
How was that the difference between ayahuasca and the 5-MeO?
The 5-MeO-DMT, I read about this in the book too. It was the most intense experience I think I've ever had.
Whoa.
On a psychedelic. Have you ever tried that?
No, I have not done that one, no. I'm always scared of it.
It's basically similar. I never did DMT, but back in the day, people used to call DMT like the businessman's trip, because like at lunch, you could take it on your lunch hour or something. Yeah. It's like a 15-minute, like a high-dose LSD trip, except it was like be over in 15 minutes rather than 10 hours with LSD. And it's the dried venom of a Sonoran desert toad, which is kind of far out on the face of it, right? And you smoke this stuff, and it's like a total. I mean, I described it as like being strapped to the side of a rocket and blasted into another galaxy. I mean, it was just intense rush where it was almost too much, where you were totally in this non-ego, almost disassociative place of pure kind of awareness or some other kind of awareness, but there's no sense of yourself, your body, your mind. You're just completely out there. I mean, you can do that with a very high dose LSD trip you know, you can kind of get there.
Yeah.
But it's just so intense, it's the rush of it. And it, so it can be kind of frightening, for one thing. And it's over in 15 minutes, although you're in this kind of timeless state. But, it, but you know, by the clock, you're it's over in 15 minutes. And for me, it was almost too much. It was hard to bring anything back from it.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's like it was so it was like a roller coaster ride or a rocket ship more than something that I could kind of learn from. And maybe there's a way to, you know, do it.
Yeah, so
I only
not,
did it the one time.
I wonder why they offer that with it, if it's not like as therapeutic as the Ibogaine is.
They sort of do it at the. I mean, they do it at the end.
Oh, okay.
I think as a. I'm not exactly sure why they. I mean, I think maybe if you're doing it with. I wasn't really, you know, there working with a therapist on it. So, but. It's certainly, sort of ontologically speaking, shows you of a whole other realm of existence that I'd never really seen. And I mean, I would like to try. I'd like to do it again and see if I could work with it more, you know, because it. I think it's just it was. And the other thing that with when I was, you know, this is something I kind of struggle with in the book is I'm there really as a journalist writing about other people's experience,
yeah.
Like with especially the Ibogaine chapter. I wasn't, you know, I'm not a heroin addict. I wasn't yeah. there for that. So I'm kind of torn between being the journalist, understanding other people's story, and then my own, you know, experience. So
yeah.
That might have been one reason it was not conducive for me to personally learn as much from it. I don't know.
Yeah, that's interesting that you would say that. Like there, as a journalist, I would think it would be hard to kind of keep your personal experience and opinions out of it if you actually took part of it. You know, like you definitely would change how your perception of the experience is for those other people. So you may inject some of your own personal views into, you know, the dialogue.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, but on the other hand, you know, it's something that's so ineffable and so beyond words that you can interview somebody about their experience and not really understand it. I think you really do have to take these things to mm-hmm. write about them. And then, you know, when you're telling the story, you don't even have to write about your experience at all, but at least you understand the nature of the experience more when you're talking to somebody about it. So I tried to do both in the book. I mean,
okay.
That was one of the struggles I had with how much of myself to put in,
yeah.
You know, and when to get out of the story.
Well, it's a great book. I mean, I've been reading it and I've enjoyed it just as much as your first book. So, you know, it's entertaining and also educational at the same time. And I think that is, something different again, you know, like I was talking about the Harvard Psychedelic Club book is that it's not a personal story about yourself the whole
right.
way through. And, I think that's something that is missing from the dialogue that's taking place on psychedelics generally today, even still today. Where do you see psychedelics going from here? I mean, like, what do you think the future of it is? You have a huge amount of knowledge about the history and what's happening now, but what do you think is going to happen in the future?
Well, you know, I'm not a prophet. I'm a journalist, so it's hard for me to really
Hey, man,
say.
If you tell me, I'll put stock in it. You got enough information on
you
it.
You know, it's really hard to say. I mean, it's like, there's been a whole wave of very positive media coverage. You know, there have been some other books recently that have been even much more successful than mine by big name journalists. You know, so there are the New York Times positive stories, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Scientific American. There's a lot of positive media coverage. There's almost like a honeymoon. You know,
yeah.
like the media
yeah.
and the government can. You know, I worked in the media for many years, the mainstream media, and we tend to like build things up and then knock them down.
Mm.
You know, and so I keep waiting for there to be some crackdown or scandal or, you know, some bad result, some political decision that we have to shut this down for some reason. I keep thinking that that's going to happen. So far it hasn't. I don't want it to happen. I'm not hoping it happens, but you know, it could, It could. And there's a lot of, you know, we don't need to get in. There's a lot of infighting within the psychedelic community that could set it back. But it you know, in terms of the clinical trials, it's looking like if things go as they're going, like, you know, within a few years, these things always take longer than they think they're going to take because they have to, you know, do this whole new round of clinical trials. But it looks like they will probably reschedule at least MDMA and then maybe psilocybin, you know, maybe within 3 or 4 years, which is not legalization, but it's it's an opening. And, you know, a lot of people, like I said before, I think it's kind of like marijuana, what happened with marijuana. There's the whole medical marijuana thing, and then that opened the door. You know, it showed people that these drugs aren't as dangerous and bad as they've been made out to be.
Yeah.
And so, and then there's the whole religious freedom aspect of it. So, it seems to be, you know, people, the reason I called the book Changing Our Minds is, you know, it's a play on that. Obviously, you're changing your own mind a bit by taking these drugs, but people's attitudes about them are also changing. And that definitely seems to be happening.
Yeah. Do you think from your experience writing this newest book, do you think that some of your mind has been changed as well through that process?
Well, you know, I've been around the block a few times.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I think I said before, you know, the proof is kind of in the pudding. I mean, it's like, it's how do these drugs change the way you live your life and relate to other people? And that's much harder. That's harder work.
Yeah.
You know, it's really easy to be have feelings of kindness and compassion and empathy when you're high on MDMA. And, you know, it may be more difficult 2 weeks later when you're having an argument with your spouse, you know, to remember that insight. And that's the trick, to remember, you know, I mean, a lot of what the way these drugs work, it's ego dissolution. You know, it's like getting outside of yourself. It's self-transcendence. By self, I mean your skin-encapsulated egotistical self, the small self.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's kind of a glimpse at another way of being. But it's just a glimpse, you know. People get too excited about the transformative power of these drugs because they seem so transformative when you're on them. But, you know, how do you feel a week later, a month later, a year later? That's the trick. And that's why the therapeutic work is important, because that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to integrate the insight into your life and how you look at yourself and do other people. So
that's great, man. That sounds like a good future, at least in my mind.
Yeah.
So do you have any websites or places that people can find your information?
Yeah, I have a website. It's donlatin.com, which is donlatin.com. And there's information about I've written 6 books, and there's information about the books. There's also our newspaper magazine articles I've written. So that's the best place to go and find out about my work. I mean, the books are available. You can order the books, you know, from your local independent bookstore, hopefully, or you can get them from Amazon you know, we always encourage people to buy our books because
yes, you put a lot of work into it.
Yeah, we have to make a living and it's not easy.
Yeah, definitely. what's the future for you?
Hard to get people to read a book these days. People are so busy and so used to looking at these little things.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I like the hard books, man. I always go back to the hard books. So having hard copy of your book is very nice to have. I can turn the pages and highlight things like that. You know, it's a little harder on the phone. But what's the future for you? What are you going to bring out next? What are you working on now?
Well, I'm kind of between projects right now. I've written 3 books on psychedelics, and I'm thinking that might be enough. So, you know, I'm working on some other. I'm exploring some other topics right now.
Okay.
But and I'm kind of taking a break. You know, we'll see. Something I always think, my latest book is my last book, and then something else comes up. So.
Cool, man.
But I'm not in any rush. You know, I turned 65, so maybe it's time to, you know, I'm sort of going into semi-retirement.
Oh, okay.
But you know, I got a couple ideas out there.
Cool.
You know, a couple irons in the fire.
Well, look forward to whatever it is, man. I'll definitely be a reader.
This episode of Cosmic Echo was brought to you by Synergetic Press. If you enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about Don Latin and his work, you can visit our website at taileaters.com/CE podcast, and there you can click on links that will take you to his work as well as his books. Additionally, if you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so through our Patreon page, located at the same website. We look forward to bringing you additional episodes in the near future. But until then, happy...